GPT-4 just came out. This is a big upgrade from the GPT-3.5 that powered ChatGPT. So everything you heard about ChatGPT is now already out of date. GPT just went from scoring in the bottom 10% of bar exam students to the top 10% of bar exam students. GPT could get into a prestigious law school now if it were human. And it's getting dramatically better every year. Not only that, but Microsoft has announced that they have started rolling GPT-4 into Microsoft Word. So everyone is going to have a write button in Word of some kind eventually. You probably don't have it yet. They haven't given it to everyone, but they are rolling it into Microsoft Word. So one of these days, you're going to click update on Microsoft Word, and suddenly Word will have AI writing powers. And don't think that the U.S. Copyright Office is going to protect you from competing with authors who are using GPT to augment their writing. Everyone's going to be using it, just like everyone uses a spell check. And yes, you can find people who are like, no, don't use a spell check built into your computer. It's more edifying for you as a human to look up every word in the paper dictionary. But those people write very, very slowly. So GPT is better than you at taking the bar exam. And it's probably better at calculus. That's another big improvement. GPT got way better at math in this most recent update. But the more important question for our purposes is, how do you ensure that GPT will never be better than you at writing, right? It's already really good at writing, but how do you keep it from being better than you at writing stories? Well, that's what we're going to talk about in this episode of Novel Marketing, the longest running book marketing podcast in the world. I'm Thomas Umstead Jr., CEO of Author Media, and this is the show for writers who want to build their platform, sell more books, and make a difference with writing worth talking about. And to understand how to write better than GPT, we need to understand its core limitations. And GPT is a mimic. You can think of it like a parrot that can repeat what it's heard, but it doesn't really understand. And it's very good at writing a book similar to other books that have been written, but it doesn't understand why those books were successful. Which brings us to an important question. Why do people read books? Why were those books successful? Why do people read fiction? And we could get really specific, right? Why do people read romance? Or why do they gravitate to Beauty and the Beast plots even after thousands of years? GPT can never understand why. And frankly, most humans don't know why either. But once you know why, you'll be equipped to always write better than the voracious writing machines, which get better every year. Now, we're not going to have time to go into every genre and break down why people read every specific subgenre, because there's thousands. But my hope is that we can get the gears turning. And as you start to think about why people read the genres, and perhaps more importantly, what mood they're wanting to be in when they're reading that kind of book, it can help you adapt your writing to resonate with the actual human doing the reading. This is the key to outwriting the machines. And to help us on this journey, we have a special guest. She's a Christie Award-winning author and a best-selling author of more than 150 books in multiple genres. Her books have sold more than 5 million copies around the world, and she's the author of Writing Lessons from the Front and a friend of the show. That's right. We're joined by none other than Angela Hunt. Welcome to Novel Marketing.
Ta-da! Thank you. I feel like I should be tap dancing or something after that great introduction. But this is going to be fun because the thought of AI out there outwriting us or getting into law school, that's a little intimidating for writers.
That's right, because a lot of those questions are written answers. And now the computers can write up the answers. It's not just picking from a multiple choice option. Computers have been able to do that for a long time.
Yeah.
So I thought we would start with an easy one, and that is dystopian. So why do people read dystopian books? So for background, if you've never read a dystopian starts with an idea, a philosophy, or a religion, and then it follows that idea to its logical conclusion. So communism seems like a good idea until you read Animal Farm. And dystopian is not fun to read, right? These are tragedies. The protagonist often fails, often dies. And so why would somebody read dystopian if it's not a fun, happy, exciting read? Well, my theory is, and Angela, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, is curiosity, right? It's what makes us who we are as humans. We want to know, even if that knowledge takes us out of paradise, right? Curiosity is our core psychological motivation, right? Given the choice between ignorant bliss and knowledge of good and evil, we reach for the fruit every time. Dystopian is the fruit that opens our eyes to the evil all around us. It allows us to see the wolves dressed as sheep and the dangers of seemingly innocent ideas. And I would argue that curiosity is the number one reason that people read books, because most of nonfiction travels through this one motivation.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I get specifically into dystopian, and my first thought is always The Hunger Games, because I really enjoyed that and read it within the last 10 years, probably, is I asked people on my Facebook page, I told them we were going to do this podcast, and I said, what are your general overall reasons for reading? And these are the main ones. One, relaxation. I don't think dystopian is very relaxing. Another one I had never thought of was nothing good on TV, because I tend to watch movies on TV. And another one, which I do think would appeal to the dystopian genre, is world travel and time travel, being removed from one's current place and put in a foreign world, not necessarily geographically foreign, but something that's not familiar to the reader, or time, a different time.
Which I would say is curiosity, right? You're curious about how people live around the world, or you're curious about how people lived in the past, and the fiction offers an answer that scratches that curiosity itch.
Yeah, exactly. Because that world and time travel is fueled by curiosity. We want to know what's going on. A lot of people read just to escape from reality. Maybe that is to relax if they're reading a certain kind of novel, but probably not dystopian. Another one that I thought was an interesting answer was to live vicariously through the protagonist. So in other words, to live in someone else's skin for a while. And that probably applies to many genres. And then corollary to that is to understand other people, their motivations, their lives. And one lady said to remember, which I thought was interesting and probably only applicable to historical fiction, she means that literally. But now, dystopian, I think you're absolutely right about the curiosity about what is another world like. And I think part of it is this yearning for knowledge, because I think you said it best when you said we see the failings of these different systems. That's why it was required reading to read 1984 and Animal Farm. But you can really see the same thing in like The Hunger Games. You see this system that's set up to take advantage of the less privileged people. Freedom is non-existence. Suffering is everywhere. So yeah, it's what would this system result in? And we get the answer in dystopian fiction.
Yeah, I would say The Hunger Games is all about decadence. It's exploring kind of the evils of decadence. And it's very brilliant because it focuses, the protagonists are the victims of decadence, because the decadence of the Romans came at the expense of the Roman slaves and the Roman gladiators. And so you'll have stories about Roman decadence like Quo Vadis that are all about the Romans. But this is a story about, you know, the people fighting in the arena effectively. And it's very telling. And this was on purpose. All of the people in the Central Core District have Latin names, right? And often straight out of Roman history. She's not hiding the ball on the dystopian elements. It's not just that things are sad in the future. And I think often for dystopians that don't work, like, oh, the future is sad, so I'm just going to do a sad story in the future. It's like, no, that's not actually going to work as a dystopian, and definitely the ending won't work. You have to actually start with the idea that you're trying to explore or debunk or take the shine off of it. And the decadence of wealth is what The Hunger Games, I think, is taking the shine off of. And that's why it works. It's also, I would say, an action adventure. It's not a pure dystopian in that many of the scenes have to do with adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it has some elements. This is one interesting thing. These different genres, as we talk about them, many books will touch on multiple of these genres. And so a type of genre that some books will have as an element is mystery. Some books, that's all it is. Mm-hmm. And mystery is an interesting distinction because with dystopian, the it's all about curiosity about something outside of the book. Right. I'm curious about totalitarianism, so I read 1984. I'm curious about communism, so I read Animal Farm. Whereas with the mystery, the curiosity is inside the book. It allows you to stay in the garden. The mystery doesn't take you out of the garden of paradise. It allows you to stay there because ultimately it's a story of order being brought to chaos. The story starts in chaos. The world is out of order. Some evil has happened. And at the end, before Sherlock Holmes leaves the last page, order has been restored. And the questions have been answered, and it's participatory, right? When you're solving a puzzle, you're bringing order to chaos, right? You have a big pile of pieces, and at the end, you have order, and you participate. You're solving it along with Sherlock Holmes. Never as good as Sherlock Holmes, but you feel like you're almost as smart as Sherlock Holmes if it's well written. And I'm using Sherlock as a stand-in for all kind of mystery protagonists. But it scratches that curiosity itch in a safe way, the way that feels fun on vacation and doesn't make you sad or existential at the end.
Right. And it usually opens with a murder, and the murder is of somebody we don't know. So we have not invested our emotions in this character yet because he's usually killed in either chapter one or the prologue. So a mystery is a puzzle. That's it. It's like people who sit down and do jigsaw puzzles. They enjoy challenging their minds, learning something new along the way, and then achieving the goal, which is to try to figure out who did it. Much different than a thriller, which is completely different. That is the race between good and evil. There's still chaos, and they both fall under the umbrella of suspense. But a thriller is about a good character versus an evil character, and they face off and do battle throughout the whole story until the big confrontation at the end. And all along, the evil guy, the villain, will have had more intellect, more money, more power, more opportunities than the good guy. But it's a morality tale really at its core because it's about good conquering evil, usually through some virtue that he has.
Yeah, and if we look at the psychology of thrillers, I think the core psychology is that of predator and prey. And this is a really interesting thing about being human, is that we are both predator and prey, right? The lions chased us, but we also chase the lions. They eat us, but we eat them back, right? This, you see this core dynamic in like children's games, right? Tag, the children take turns being predator and prey. In hide and seek, the children take turns being predator and prey. My small children, their favorite game to play with me right now is the game they call the boom boom game, where I pretend to be a giant and chase them around the house. And if I catch them, I tickle them and cover them with kisses, and they're giggling and they're having fun. And I, when I'm playing this game, I have this sense that I am participating in an act that dads have been doing to like the misty dawn of time, which is actually an important thing in that I'm allowing my children to practice being prey. Because you, when you need to be prey, you need to be good at it, right? You need to be the rabbit that escapes, not the rabbit that gets eaten, right? Mm-hmm. And the worst thing that happens when they get captured by giant daddy is that they get kissed and tickled. But when my ancestors did this with their children, the worst thing that happened was that the lion eats you, right? Like it's, and it was still a fun game, but it was teaching a very fundamental skill. But also, what's interesting is that we're not stuck being prey forever, right? There's no lions in Europe. There are no bears in Texas, right? Mm-hmm. We did such a good job. We made the predators go extinct, or our ancestors did. And thrillers take that dichotomy of being predator and prey and put it into story form. Sometimes it switches back and forth, or sometimes it only switches at the very end, right? That classic Rambo line, you're not hunting him, he's hunting you. And suddenly the protagonist comes into the knowledge or comes into the power. Now the antagonist, the villain, is the one who's being afraid. And now James Bond is chasing the villain rather than the villain chasing James Bond.
That's very good. And when you think about it, even the earliest tales that we hear as children, like the tale of Peter Rabbit, make Peter human for a minute. You've got Peter's mother warning him, Mr. McGregor ate your father, so don't go in that garden. And I mean, that's horrifying. But when you turn it into cute little bunnies, kids learn the lesson. You don't do dangerous things. Stranger danger. You don't go in places where you could have serious consequences. But yeah, we've been teaching these stories to our children and learning these lessons for a long time.
And broadening out to suspense. I feel like suspense, again, going back to like core children's games, core psychological motivators, it's just a race, right? It's the simplest of all competitions. Who is going to get to the goal first? Now, good suspense is not the 100-meter dash, right? It's an obstacle course with twists and turns, and maybe they realize they were racing to the wrong place and they have to change directions. But you want to know, is Indiana Jones going to be able to get to the Holy Grail before the Nazis do, right? It's a race. And, you know, at one point he's flying in the air and he's digging in tunnels and he's fighting with snakes, right? And none of these things seem to have anything to do with the Holy Grail, but finally he gets there, right? But it's satisfying, right? Mm-hmm. You're anticipating it and you're curious and you're enjoying the adventure of watching the race. And you can incorporate race elements or suspense elements into thrillers and into mysteries and really into any of the other kind of genres. And it, adding that clock, because you can race against a person, but you can also race against the clock, right? We have 7 days before the bomb goes off. We have to find the bomb kind of clock. Or my beloved is going to get marry the wrong man in 7 days. I have 7 days to break up the wedding, right? There's different ways you can put the clock into the story. And it adds tension and it makes it, again, takes people back to that childhood fun of who's faster. Like my 4-year-old and my 3-year-old race each other all the time. Uh-huh. The 4-year-old always wins, but they're always curious. Maybe this time it will be different. Let's race again.
Yeah. And there are other things that are common to those stories, like the best friend who helps you 3/4 of the way through the journey and then suddenly betrays you. It's the same story with different elements tossed in.
And understanding that psychological motivator is what helps inform you when to throw in those elements, right? GPT is always going to do that kind of randomly, but you can do it on purpose and you can do it knowing why. Why overcoming the obstacles is that fun? And so you're like, how do I know why? It's like, go back to when you were a kid. Remember when you were a kid. Remember who you are. You are a human. You're not just a node on the internet. And as you can put in that childlike joy and give it, and you're like, but this is a suspense of trying to save the end of the world. It's like, yes, but there's still a childlike joy in the fun of saving the world or the fun of trying. And as you can incorporate that into your writing, it'll be better than what the robots can do. Speaking of robots, we should probably talk about science fiction.
Oh, yes.
Now, most science fiction these days is actually dystopian. True science fiction is kind of rare. So like I'm thinking like the Jetsons or Star Trek. And in that kind of science fiction, everyone's rich, everyone has dignity, everyone has purpose. And Star Trek, there's a strict meritocracy where the most competent people have the job that most needs that competence. Everyone's in exactly the right role. And these utopian science fiction stories are paradise, right? People want a break from the broken world that they live in to go spend some time in a paradise world where the struggles are very external, right? The struggles are outside of the enterprise, right? The enterprise is a place of safety and competence and opulence, really, definitely of plenty. And it's a fun place to be. And science fiction is a very optimistic genre based off on the underlying belief that things are getting better and will continue to get better. That's like a core conceit of old school science fiction. So if science fiction is the Garden of Eden, dystopian is the fruit of knowledge, right? That takes us out of the garden, right? We read science fiction when we're wanting to feel optimistic. We read dystopian when we want to know the truth. And we're in different moods, right? Somebody may love both, right? But they're going to reach for Hunger Games in a certain mood, and they're going to reach for Star Trek novel when they're in a different mood.
So it's utopian versus dystopian. When I was in high school, I really loved the science fiction of Isaac Asimov and especially Michael Crichton, The Andromeda Strain. So I wouldn't call that one utopian because it was kind of like, well, it was the theme of Jurassic Park, the novel, which was when we start overstepping our bounds and start messing around with nature, then nature's going to come back and swat us. And I found that theme a lot in what I would call science fiction. Not necessary planetary exploration, but dealing with science, particularly medical science novels.
Yeah. I would put, in terms of these psychological motivators, I would put Jurassic Park and really a lot of Michael Crichton's work in the dystopian. Mm-hmm. And Jurassic Park's really clear, right? He's exploring chaos theory. Malcolm, yes, in the book has whole chapters where he's preaching chaos theory like a pastor at a pulpit. Mm-hmm. There's often like dinosaurs nibbling on the bars of the room, and he's there laying in the medical bed talking about chaos theory. But it's exactly what you say. It's like, hey, what if we try to control nature too much and this bad things happen? So it may get put on the science fiction shelf. And this is, again, the robots will think, oh, this is science fiction just like all the other science fictions, when it's got a fundamental difference. And I think that dystopian science fiction, or science fiction with dystopian elements, is far more popular. Star Wars is very dystopian. If you look at the aesthetic design of it, there's very much the sense, yes, that the former greatness has fallen, right? There's no shiny ships, right? All the ships are run down and broken. All of the locations are messy and gritty, and most of the people are poor, right? And suffering. It's very much a dystopian as opposed to Star Trek, where the ships are shiny, the things do, yeah, work, the cities are beautiful, and there's a much more optimistic worldview to the story. And I think that these things go in and out of fashion. I think right now people are, mm-hmm, feeling very melancholy, very pessimistic, and dystopian elements resonate with, sure, people more right now. In 20 years, that's going to really shift. In 40 years from now, it'll be just the opposite if you follow pendulum theory in terms of, mm-hmm, cultural proclivities. And if you look at when science fiction was really popular, you go back 40 years and you're like, oh yeah, true science fiction was more popular back then than it is now. And dystopians were still around, but they didn't have the kind of ever presence that they seem to in current fiction. So we talked about science fiction. Let's go to the other nerd genre of fantasy, or epic fantasy. So I've been thinking, like, why do people like fantasy? And I have two theories as to the core psychological itch that fantasy scratches. And the first one is that we want to believe as humans that our choices matter, that they make a difference. The core fantasy in fantasy isn't that magic is real, although that's the other fantasy. We want magic to be real. But more fundamentally, we want to matter, right? Fantasy, uh-huh, tends to start with a nobody with no power. Harry Potter living under stairs, Frodo Baggins living with his uncle, right? Aragorn, the poor peasant. And typically by the end of the story, this person who didn't matter because of the choices they made is now the most important person in the world, right? When the moment when Frodo is fighting with Gollum in Mount Doom, he and Gollum are the most important people of the world. Those two determine the fate of all of the races of Middle Earth, right? Uh-huh. When Harry Potter is facing against Voldemort, he's the one person on the planet who can stop this evil from taking over. And that's the fantasy, right? We want to feel like we matter. And reading an epic fantasy, reading the story of From Nobody to Somebody, makes us feel like we're somebody. In a context where we also want to believe that dragons are real, right? We want to believe, uh-huh, that dragons are real because we want to believe that they can be slain, right? The world is a scary place and we want to feel brave. And epic fantasy, when done well, gives us that brave feeling.
This is interesting because I actually don't like fantasy. I know. And I'm trying to, as you were explaining that, I was trying to sort of psychoanalyze myself thinking, why wouldn't I like to feel like my choices matter or something? I don't know. I used to think it's because I'm just very pragmatic and practical. And everything I write, even my novels, they're all very rooted in reality. So I used to just chalk it up to that. But I think you have a point. I mean, everybody feels that they are special. And sometimes we get irked when the world doesn't realize just how special we are. Of course, if we publicize that, then we're full-blown narcissists. But I do think you're probably right in that that's exactly why it appeals to people.
So I'm a little curious. So on the nature, nurture, free will, predestination spectrum, where do you land on that? Because I'm curious if this impacts if this impacts people's love. Yeah.
I do. Well, I am. Yeah, I'm in God is sovereign and everything's predetermined. Yeah, I'm firmly in that camp.
Okay. Which is very telling because you're like, I want my books to be real, right? It's been predetermined, so your choices don't matter, or at least don't matter to the degree that they would in, say, Middle Earth, because, you know, the world is structured, right? We are a product of our nature. I know some of you listening are religious, some of you are not, but the debate is basically the identical debate. They just use different terms. It's free will, predestination, and religious communities. Sure. It's nurture and nature in scientific communities. And the science people will go at each other on nurture and nature just as much as the religious people will. And it's interesting because this is a genre that allows you to have something to say about that very core debate in that very core question, right? Am I the way that I am because of the choices I've made, or am I the way that I am because of the environment that I'm in and the choices that other people have made or other beings have made? And epic fantasy allows you to explore that. And I feel like you can do epic fantasy in a nature or a nurture direction. But I think that the core fantasy is the, I want free will to be real, and epic fantasy lets me feel that that's the case, even if deep down I believe that I'm a product of my environment.
Well, and I do believe that we have free will on our plane of existence. But I also believe there's a higher plane of existence than ours. And so we can't control everything. We can't say, I want to fly and go jump out a window and do it. So there are limits to human abilities. And maybe that's the thing I just can't ignore.
And I think this is an important point. As we're talking about these different genres, no one is a fan of all the genres, or very few people are. And no one is a fan of all the genres all the time, right? They're in a specific mood. And so when you're writing a book, you need to be thinking about who specifically am I writing to and what mood are they wanting to be in? These are questions that computer can't ask. But if you're continually revisiting these questions, as we are revisiting the questions even in this very episode, it will help you refocus on what makes your book work for who it works with, right? If you're trying to write an epic fantasy for the Angela Hunts in the world, it's not going to sell very well because that's a tough sell, right? You want to write an epic fantasy for the Thomas Umstead's of the world who are already like, dragons, shut up and take my money. love dragons.
The most popular genre in the world is romance. And I'm not particularly keen on romance either. I like books with romantic elements. I'm happily married. I believe in love and marriage. But a book whose sole purpose is to get a guy together with a girl and they live happily ever after, I'd rather pick up something else.
So speaking of dragons and romance, Beauty and the Beast plots, right? So why do readers read romance? So there's different romantic plots. I felt like we need to break romance into different kind of subcategories. But I think the most resonant romantic plot over time has been the Beauty and the Beast plot. In the Disney film, says the tale as old as time. And it turns out that that's true, right? You can find Beauty and the Beast plots in the Bible, Cupid and Psyche, Pride and Prejudice, right up to the modern day. And so why the appeal? Why has this story resonated with readers for thousands of years and is still today some of the best-selling animated films, even some of the best-selling romantic stories ever, are based off of this plot? So I have some theories I want to float by you, and this is good because we have a man here and a woman. We get the two different perspectives. Okay. But here's my theory. Some women, at least, want to feel beautiful, wanted, safe, and rich. And often in a Beauty and the Beast plot, the woman falls in love with the man's safety or wealth before she falls in love with the man, right? Ruth falls in love with Boaz's food before falling in love with him. Elizabeth Bennet falls in love with Mr. Darcy's house before falling in love with him. Belle falls in love with Beast's books before falling in love with Beast's. And then the woman helps civilize the man, brings the man from barbarity into civilization, right? Beast learns table manners, Darcy learns humility, and Boaz learns that he's not too old for love. And these stories resonate with readers because women are a civilizing force on men. They have been for probably the whole history of civilization, right? This is as true today, I would say, as it was when the first woman handed the first man a bar of soap in the ancient past. It's like, hey, I just invented this. Go wash, right? I guarantee you soap was invented by women. I have no scientific proof for that, but I believe it in my core, right? And so in many ways, it's kind of like a mystery in that in a Beauty and the Beast story, order is brought to chaos, right? The man brings order to the woman's chaos by providing that wealth and that protection, right? The scene in Disney's Beauty and the Beast where Beast jumps in between Belle and the wolves is key. That's the transformation, really, where finally the viewer is actually finally rooting for Beast, I feel like. Because at that point, Beast is the villain, but he transitions to the hero. And Belle follows him home and cares for his needs. And it's unattractive for a man to hide behind his woman in the face of danger, right? It's true. Attractive for the man to get in between woman and danger, right? Conan
yes.
places himself between the monster and the woman. That's the attractive kind of picture of manhood that is presented in these stories. And when done well, I feel like this plot is very emotionally satisfying because they're bringing order to each other's lives. And it's because the man needs the order that the woman brings and the woman needs the order that the man brings.
Okay. I agree with some of that and I disagree with a bit of it. I disagree with the woman is attracted to the man's ex, his books, his wealth, his house, because love is about the person, not about the things. Now, the books may have been what attracted Belle to Beast's palace, and sometimes it's attractiveness, but women in romances always see the man as a beast, not necessarily in appearance, but in manners or understanding or lack thereof. So it's all about the women are drawn to the men, but they have to, quote, tame them so that they can be the men that the women need him to be, which he probably would have been all along if she could see past his beastliness. Anyway, like I said, this is not my genre.
And I'll admit it's not my genre either. So instead of sending me your angry emails to thomas@authormedia.com, leave a comment on this episode, either at authormedia.com or authormedia.social, and let's have this conversation. There may be some big element here that Angela and I are missing. So instead of sending it to us privately, send it to us publicly so that we can all chime in on why readers read romance. Because I feel like if you have the answer to this, it's really helpful. And while we're talking about romance, we should also talk about romantic comedies. So Beauty and the Beast plots tend to be very serious.
Yes.
But there's also a silliness to romantic love. Men and women are very similar, mm-hmm. but they're also very different. And those differences lead to confusion. And that confusion is hilarious,
yes.
especially for a third party observer. It's less hilarious in the moment, but somebody stepping aside and watching, it's like, this whole men and women thing is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I think it's important not to take ourselves too seriously, right? So Beauty and the Beast is a plot. Has a temptation to take itself too seriously. And romantic comedy is kind of like the dystopia, right? If science fiction is Beauty and the Beast, then romantic comedy is like dystopian. It's like the apple that's like, yeah, you're not all that in a bag of chips. You're really both quite ridiculous. And mm-hmm. I feel like the kind of king of romantic comedy plots is Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. And some of the jokes there are still funny, right? Bawdy humor goes back to the very origins of the language. Some of the very earliest English writings are full of bedroom humor, right? Mm-hmm. The Canterbury mm-hmm. Tales are full of this sort of thing, and it's still funny. It's still ridiculous, which is remarkable because humor typically doesn't age well. Something that's funny to a parent isn't funny to a child, and certainly not funny 100 years later, except this is, because this is something that's deeply comic about romantic relationships.
Right. Men from Mars, women from Venus. And it's always been that way, and it always will be.
Now, if you're looking at a Beauty and the Beast plot, that whole story structure is kind of from the woman's perspective. And I was like, what is the male perspective on that same sort of story? And I would say it's a monster hunter book. So there's a male fantasy of protecting your family from the bad guys and doing it with your weapon, right? It's the little boys waving swords with sticks in the yard. You see it in the Christmas story when Ralphie daydreams of shooting the burglars with his Red Ryder BB gun, right? The bad guys are trying to get into the house and he's there with his BB gun, shooting them and chasing them off, right? We already talked about Conan the Barbarian placing himself in between the danger and the woman. And so, you know, like, what's a good modern example of this? And I feel like this is the reason why the Monster Hunter International books have been so fantastically successful because, one, they don't face a lot of competition. There's not a lot of writers writing to this particular fantasy that mm-hmm. men have. And it's a really core, enduring psychological, like, itch that a lot of readers have to scratch. There's a lot of people who buy their first shotgun and deep down they really wish that vampires or zombies were real. And these books allow you to live the fantasy of rednecks with shotguns keeping the world safe from vampires and zombies and all manner of evil creatures. And that's why they sold millions of copies.
Well, I was trying to think of a romance where, like, the man is the main character and the story is told from his point of view. Honestly, I can't think of one. But I think what happens is a man demonstrates his love for his wife, his child, as you said, in defending them, defending their honor, defending their physical safety. And the first thing that pops into my head are like the Taken movies with Liam Neeson. And that's how he's proving his love, is you're not going to take my daughter. You're not going to take my wife. And so those, technically, they're not romances. They're thrillers because he always goes after the bad guys and to rescue his wife or child or his beloved person. So maybe that's what thrillers are in that situation. They're romance for men.
And Conan is returning. Conan the Barbarian is entering the public domain in 3 or 4 years. And so we have forgotten as a people who Conan the Barbarian is, because Conan the Barbarian is an articulation of a view of manhood, but he's also an articulation of a view of the decadence of civilization. So Conan is a very kind of anti-civilization, anti-corruption character. And there's an important distinction between sword and sorcery, which we're not really getting into, and epic fantasy. Those are not the same genre at a core psychological level, even though if you're just looking at them, they seem really similar, right? It's wizards and people with swords and elves and magic. And the Hollywood doesn't understand this, which is why the Conan films often don't work very well, because they don't know what a sword and sorcery story is. And they don't realize that it's all about corruption and civilization. And the barbarian part isn't just describing Conan physically. It's describing him spiritually and like his mission. He's not a part of civilization and he doesn't follow civilization's rules. And my prediction is, and I've said this before, I'll do it now again, Conan is coming. Some authors are going to take Conan once he enters the public domain and they're going to start doing some interesting things with him. And some of those books, I suspect, are going to be very resonant because for the first time ever, anyone will be able to write a Conan story without asking for permission.
Wow.
So while we're talking about controversial things, let's go to the final category that I have here, which is coming of age books, which is a genre that is gone out of fashion. This is a very out of fashion genre right now. And I should make a distinction. Coming of age is a plot structure. It's a way of forming a plot. It's not the same as YA. YA is an audience. Any of these genres that we've done could be made for a YA audience and have been, right? That YA is describing a kind of reader, not a kind of book. But coming of age book is a specific kind of plot that is particularly targeted at that younger reader. And to understand a coming of age book, you have to understand civilizations that are not ours, because we don't really believe in manhood the way that the ancient civilizations did and the tribal civilizations still do. So if you go to various cultures around the world, they have this distinction between an adult male and a man. And you can be an adult male without being accepted by the men as one of the men. And there's often a very ritualized process of going from a boy to a man. You see this in Native American cultures. You see it in African tribes. You see it in Asian tribes. You even see it in bar mitzvahs today, right? It's like, hey, this is how you become a man. This is what it means to be a man and be accepted by the men as one of us. And a coming of age book offers an answer to that question. So in some ways, it's a curiosity motivator, like dystopian, where a young man's like, what does it mean to be a man? It's like, here's a book that helps answer that question, right? It's Old Yeller. It's learning how to do the difficult thing for the protection of your family, right? Killing the dog that has rabies is difficult. You love that dog. You don't want to do it. But part of being a man is protecting your family from harm. And rabies is dangerous, especially back then when there's no rabies shot. And the right thing to do is the painful thing to do. And being a man means doing that right thing and killing your dog so that he doesn't infect everybody else with rabies and you stop the rabies. And grappling with that emotionally. And boy, howdy, is this not a popular genre today.
Just the
idea that manhood is a thing that's separate from being an adult human. Even that is the whole construct now has become very controversial. And what I'm curious is there a form of coming of age that applies to women? Because I will say when I was young, this was not a question I was asking. So I wasn't reading, you know, female coming of age stories.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of them. But the first one that sprung to my mind was To Kill a Mockingbird, which is told from Scout's point of view. And it's about the summer that that trial was going on. So she learned lessons. To me, a coming of age story is when a person tells a story, either in real time or as a extended flashback, of the time in their life when they matured and learned an important life lesson. And so to me, To Kill a Mockingbird is exactly what you said, a female coming of age novel. I never read Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret by Judy Blume, but I've heard that described as a coming-of-age novel, but I can't speak intelligently about what it's about because I never read that one.
Let us know in the chat. I'm sure all of you are shouting at your phones right now. It's like, what about this book? It's a perfect example. So in the chat, authormedia.social, we always have a thread at www.authormedia.social for each episode. There's also comments under the blog post version. You can chime in there. And let us know good examples of coming of age books, both for men and for women, and what's different about them. Because I feel like we've been talking about gender differences in some of these genres, and you definitely see it in the sales, right? Romance by far sells to women, for example. I think coming of age books have that same kind of breakdown where you're either writing for a young man or you're writing for young women.
Yes, exactly.
So hopefully this has gotten the gears turning. Hopefully it's triggered you just a little bit because in that emotional response, whether happy or sad or angry, is your competitive advantage against the robots because they can't do that. They're not going to have that kind of reaction. And so what we've done in, I don't know, a dozen different genres, I want each one of you to do with your specific subgenre. Because while epic fantasy may have one why, your urban fantasy story may have a different why. The reason people read urban fantasy may not be the same reason that people read epic fantasy. And as you are crystal clear on that why, as you are crystal clear on the itch that your book is scratching, that's what's going to give you an edge, not just about writing better than the robot, but also it's going to give you an edge writing the pitch for your book. It's going to give you an edge selling your book. It's going to make it easier to convince readers to try your book. All of the marketing flows from this. So if you don't write the kind of book that people want to read, that they're not itching to read, then none of the rest of it matters because you can't fix a bad book with good marketing. And by bad, I don't mean poorly written, right? Because GPT can write perfectly good prose with good grammar. What I mean is well written for what the reader is wanting. And once you write the good book, everything else gets easier. And if you're wanting help writing a good book, I would highly recommend Angela Hunt's excellent books on craft. She wrote these little pamphlets, basically. They're very focused, called Writing Lessons from the Front. And I'll have a link in the show notes to a 10-book volume of Writing Lessons from the Front. It's fantastic. Angela, tell us a little bit about what some of those lessons are.
There's a volume on creating memorable characters. There's a volume on creating tension to keep readers turning the pages. There's a volume that's very practical, how to plot. There's another one, how to make time to write every day. Just that sort of thing. And I just wanted to backtrack for 1 minute when you said emotion. You know, that's why people read novels, period. Yes, they like learning things in a story, but if they just only wanted to learn things, they would read a nonfiction book. So novels are emotional journeys that people want to learn from. And I think that's one of the most important things to keep in mind as you write. And that's the weakness of GPT.
Well said. Angela Hunt Books is the website. If you want to find Angela's books, and we'll have a link to them in the show notes. But I really do encourage you to get started with her writing lessons from the front. She has really good practical advice on how you can make your writing better right away. It's not 200 pages to do it. It's 50 pages to do it. And that little bit of simplicity makes all the difference. So, Angela, thank you so much for joining us today on the Novel Marketing Podcast.
It's my pleasure. It's always interesting to talk to you, Thomas.
Our featured patron today is Daniel Bishop, author of Place of Refuge. Dinah Jo knew she was meant to be a mom. Her body disagreed. After a devastating miscarriage, she starts to research foster care and adoption. Will heaven send a baby to a family full of love to give? Find out in Place of Refuge by Daniel Bishop. First off, thank you, Daniel, for being a patron of the podcast, helping keep this show on the air. And I'd like to say that this month's patrons only Q&A, we're going to dive deeper into the why behind the genre. So if you write in a genre we didn't talk about in this episode of the podcast, come to the patrons only episode. You can come on screen and we will talk about your specific book, your specific genre, and the psychological reasons why someone would want to read your book. So that patrons only episode is available to all patrons, and you will see the information for how to attend that event or how to watch or listen to the replay at patreon.com/novelmarketing. The Novel Marketing Podcast is a production of authormedia.com. Our producer is Lori Christine. This episode's audio was edited by William Umstadt, and the blog post version is crafted by Shauna Lettler. To read the blog version of this episode, visit authormedia.com/364. I'm Thomas Umstadt Jr. saying thank you for listening and live long and prosper.